Gentlemen, we are back, and it is Logos Media's Unspun episode. What is this? Episode 125. I've got Marshall, or I call him Casey. I've always known him as Casey Pfeiffer on the show with us today. He's an architect. We are going to be doing the first show, if you can believe this, folks, out of all the stuff I've covered, I've never once done a show in 10 years on 9/11, on September 11th. So this is the very first one. Casey was on years ago with Freeman Bird. I've known Casey for about 7 years or so. He's an old friend, hung out at his house many times. He's been up here a couple of times. But so we wanted to get in and just, you know, start a conversation on this, because Casey is an architect and he's got the architectural understanding of buildings and things like that. And he's a member of Architects and Engineers and all of that. And so there's plenty down there in the show notes below the episode to find out more about who he's worked with and the things he's done, and some links that he's provided there to check out for everybody. Casey, welcome back.
Oh, thanks so much, John. I appreciate the opportunity. It's really nice to get a chance to talk about this topic with you on today's date.
You want to tip your camera down just a little bit? We're cutting your chin off there. There you go.
Okay. And I mean, it's nice to get some exposure, so I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this subject. To clarify a few things. I'm a structural engineer, which is similar to being an architect in that I work with architects all the time.
Okay.
And all
the time at your house, you were always doing something architecture-y type
stuff.
That's
right. That's right. Yeah. Always designing buildings. That was what I've been doing since 1996. Started out in Delaware and then have been in California for the majority of my career. And of course, the event happened right at the beginning of my life here in California in 2001, and it was a bit of a shocker, as I tell people. And this is, for me, it's nice to start off with this quick point that when it happened, I wasn't too political, didn't really pay attention to news, so I didn't treat it as much of an event the day it happened. Everybody in the office treated it as if it was a big event. And of course it was. And the buildings collapsed really quickly. And everybody in the office said that the buildings collapsed. And I said, there's no way they can collapse. And I said, what do you mean? They're like, yeah, they fell to the ground. I'm like, yeah, whatever. And I didn't actually see anything of the buildings until later that night, whenever I got a chance to watch a flat screen TV. So the first time I was able to see a flat screen TV went to some guy's party. I guess it was a memorial party for the buildings, if you will. And went to his place and saw on high def flat screen TV the first collapsing images of the Twin Towers.
And you just saw the bad CGI of the planes hitting the towers too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, I mean, the shock and awe of that day put me into a stupor as it relates to what my initial thought was for what it took until 2005 or 2006. It was about the same time. I met you shortly after I started to realize what was going on, because I started to try to find people and connect dots, and you were in California, so I said, hey, can we meet, you know? And that's how we met.
I think I probably waited like 6 months or a year to actually meet you, because I didn't really like meeting people, you know?
Right. Well, of course, it's a strange world, because you never really, as you've experienced over time, you never really know who you're working with or who you're talking to.
Yeah, and half the people you meet end up being dirty or whatever, and it's like, oh, again?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're lucky in that fact that neither of us are that. I'm about as straight away as it comes. I do structural engineering every day. I do other things as well, but mostly my main job is structural engineering, 5 days a week. And
right where you're sitting, in fact.
Yeah, this is the office. It's a home office, and I not many people. The amazing part about the structural engineering world is nobody really looks you up. The only people that actually look me up are new residential clients where I'm helping them out with the house. They'll look up my name, and they'll ask me about this event, the 9/11 event, and the buildings. And so it's interesting to have that conversation, but most of my main clients do not look me up because they already know me. So they never type in, who is Marshall Casey Pfeiffer? And I mean, if you type that into Google, first thing you get is videos from the 9/11 experts speak out. And
I didn't even know that you had done videos and stuff on it back then, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, to me, it's a topic that's a little bit strange for me because it's so obvious. And I went through a whole phase of where I was trying to talk to other colleagues, engineers, about 9/11 and you have to look into this. And they treated me as if I was crazy, and it, you know, really kind of put a little bit of a wedge for me into the topic that, you know, I don't need to get this kind of weird perception from people and energy from people. I'm just not gonna hammer it home because it's so ridiculously obvious in terms of the conservation of momentum. So engineers and almost everybody understands what conservation of momentum is whenever a force hits another equal force, it has to have a reaction. Something has to happen. And so what happened on 9/11 was three buildings collapsed without any reaction whatsoever, meaning it dropped at free fall acceleration. Now, people that like to debunk things, they'll say it didn't happen at free fall. They'll say, but it happened at near free fall. Nothing can move at near free fall with something in the way.
Especially with all the metal and steel and everything underneath it, right?
Yeah.
And all of that has to be removed first, you know?
The best analogy I like a Prius or a Mini or a smart car, one of those tiny little cars. And that car goes head on at full speed, as fast as it can go, into a semi. What do you think happens?
It dents the bumper of the semi, and everybody in the dumb car, I call them dumb cars, dies.
Right. So on that day, we have a Prius, which is about the size of, you know, a car relative, sitting on top of this big semi below. And it's a semi because it is, the buildings get stronger as they go down. And so as you're getting stronger, as you go down, it is that much stronger than the little piece above. So you're talking about a little Prius trying to pile drive a semi into the ground and make it disappear. And it just, there's a couple of cool things that are going on. One, there is a study that was done by Leroy Halsey out of the University of Alaska, where he's going to present his modeling of Building 7. And we watched Building 7. Most people didn't watch it. Most people don't even know it exists. But for those, if you want to look for it, you can see Building 7 drop just like the other Twin Towers, except there's no big explosions. There's no massive explosions.
And that's where the FBI was headquartered.
Yes. All of those FBI, all of the various, all kinds of things were in Building 7, including all kinds of lawsuit information as it relates to huge corruption with the energy crisis that went on in California.
Enron, wasn't it? The Enron scandal?
Right.
Yeah.
So all of those documents are in there as well. And those are all pieces and parts of the story. But when you look at that building, one, it was identified 20 minutes prior by the BBC that it had collapsed. And then two, it collapsed in complete controlled demolition, perfect fashion.
Well, you know, not everybody, many people saw that British newscaster
right,
reporting that Building 7 had already fallen as it starts falling behind them.
Exactly. And even there's a lawsuit where a guy got out of in England, you have to pay for TV apparently, and it's some kind of requirement. For people that don't know how to deal with the legal system, they all have to pay for TV. So this guy sued saying that BBC is some kind of fraudulent thing because of they showed something that happened with pre-knowledge. And he got out of his TV contract. I mean, it's a really stupid lawsuit, but he got it out of his TV contract by showing evidence of this moment in time. So it was already accepted in court as a fact that existed, that the BBC, I mean, it has been shown, not at that time, but it has been shown since, that it's a fact and was accepted in a court of law in England. So the model that Leroy Halsey has put together will show, I mean, he's going to set it up where he will control demolition the building through progressive collapse using engineering software to show that it actually came down as a controlled demolition, that these things had to happen for it to drop. And his model will look like the TV. So whenever you look at any other engineering model that has been put out there, you won't see it look like the TV. The building kind of half collapses, comes off at a little angle, and parts of it collapse. But the reality is their model can't predict what was seen on TV. Furthermore, he's proven to a 0% chance that the official story has any credibility, 0% chance that any of that could have fallen. And furthermore, there was a lawsuit in, around 2015, 2016, where it was shown by another engineering company, Weidlinger and Associates, that the collapse scenario that the NIST reported, that a girder failed, could not have even brought down one floor below it, much less taken down the entire building. So it's already been, evidence has already been dropped into court of law in 2016, showing that the official narrative of the Building 7 collapse is completely false.
Now, as far as historically speaking, that's the first time a fire or an airplane knocked down a skyscraper, much less two of them.
Much less three of them.
Much less three of them, and one of them didn't get hit. So
that's right.
It was like, I don't know, maybe the first or second tower farted on the Building 7, and then that's what made it come down. I'm just hypothesizing. You know, I just wanted to say, too, you know, today is my niece's 18th birthday, so this happened on her first birthday, so she gets to hear all of this nonsense every day on her birthday. So happy birthday, Hannah, out there for your big 18th today. But you know, so it's just really interesting. And I have a whole collection of videos on my server here on 9/11 videos, and of course we saw like Loose Change and those guys get catapulted into stardom and stuff for doing this, and you start fact checking a lot of their stuff. And while a lot of these early videos were telling the truth that it was an inside job, they were misdirecting and misleading the research, sending people in 100 different directions, so to speak. And I remember there was like September clues in a number of these videos. But, you know, all of these people, in my opinion, were disinformation. I think, in my opinion, in my personal opinion, Judy Wood is another one, and somebody's saying, oh, that's the piece that the most important one to read. I have never been it's never, her work has never impressed me, is what I'm trying to say. And when you use the trivium and start going through it, it falls apart too. There was a Russian guy, I'm forgetting his name now, who did an interesting thing on possibly weapons being underground, that were placed underground long before that went off. And his actually seemed maybe the most plausible to me. I can't remember his name. Somebody in the chat group mentioned it last week, and now I can't remember it off the top of my head. But so all of these things have come out. And, you know, to me, you know, there was one primary group of people behind the 9/11, the events of September 11, but we were told another group did it, a big red herring, et cetera. Have you looked into any of that, or do you just focus on the engineering aspect?
Well, it's impossible to not look past all the look into all the various elements.
Dmitry Kolizov, thank you for that. And that was Holly, my wife, that posted that. Thanks for remembering who that was. But yeah, his actually seemed the best. But it appears to me that Israel was really behind it. I'm just going to throw that out there. That's my personal opinion. Everybody, you had the people dancing on the cars in the parking lot and all of this stuff, all of the misdirection.
So even on the Israel side of it, a really damning, there's a lot of damning information as it relates to it. So there is these photos that somehow got on the internet of art students inside of the World Trade Center tower, surrounded by stacks of explosive ignition devices. And whenever you look at the impact zone of each plane and you look at the renovation schedule for each of the buildings, you will find that the exact outline of the building is shown in places where offices were renovated. So offices were renovated in this tower and at the same exact location where the planes hit. For me, the logical conclusion is that something happened during those renovations, and to me, explosives were set off at the location of the impact. There's so much information, and the group at AE9/11 Truth, they don't really want to go down these paths of looking into these situations because they want to stick to the narrative, the reality that there's no way that the buildings could have collapsed based on the current official story. There's just no chance. And by sticking to that, it cuts out some of the ad hominem attacks of like, oh, you think this theory, you think that planes never hit, you think this, you think that all these things. There's a lot of facts that go into it, but you know, the Israel idea, without a doubt, they were involved in a way, but they weren't the only.
Correct.
They weren't the only ones involved. The depth of complicity is so deep that it's staggering across all the various countries. There's more than just Israel. I mean, there's Saudi Arabia is deeply involved at some level. The United States, people within the United States obviously are deeply involved at some level. You can't, the Rumsfelds, the Cheneys, the Bushes,
the only ones I would say probably were not involved were like, you know, Osama bin Laden and the Afghanistanis and et cetera.
Yeah. So even you track down the Osama bin Laden idea and you'll find that nobody has actually implicated them in any kind of lawsuit or made any criminal charges against them. So there are none.
Right.
So if somebody commits a crime of that nature, charges would be levied, but they were not. And, you know, Osama bin Laden is such a fun little scapegoat for the world.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, you know, Obama came out and I did that pop-up fallacies video about it. But, you know, Obama came out announcing that they had captured Osama bin Laden and killed him. I think that was the 11th time that he had died, you know, within several years. So they just kept repeating it and repeating it that he was dead. And it's like, how many times can you kill the same guy, you know? It's like, you know, Kenny in South Park.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you always wonder about the South Park guys, how much they actually know. The other problems with the bin Laden family is that I believe the reports are that the certain parts of the Bin Laden family were actually in Houston, Texas, on the day, and they flew out after the no-fly zone was set up, meaning nobody, no more, all planes were, you know, grounded. So, I mean, there's way too much connectivity across the political.
Who are your, you mentioned a few, who are your other key suspects behind it?
I mean, within the, I mean, there's tons, because when you look at, I mean, even the financial, you track down the financial side and you see all kinds of people investing money with pre-knowledge, investing money into the stock market with pre-knowledge into the events of 9/11. You see it's so deep. What's the guy that Silverstein?
That guy. Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
That guy's deeply tied in, and
Bush.
Well, right. Yeah, I mean, one of the Bushes, Marvin, was head of the Securicom, which was the head of the security of the buildings on that day. There's so many problems with it, but for me, the best I can do, as far as I can tell, is be the expert in structural engineering and highlight the deficiencies in the report that was given by the government.
So let me ask you this. Is September 11, 2001 the only day that terrorist attacks have ever happened?
No.
And so we have September 11, 1973 Chilean coup d'etat. We have Palestine September 11, 1922. And that's the British mandate, and right there. And, what else? There was another one I wanted to bring up. Now I'm forgetting what it was. Maybe somebody in the chat can remind me. I think Holly had mentioned it. But, a lot of these things are historically, isn't it? September 11 is a Masonic day, isn't it?
Well, September 11 is that, but then there's also this idea that it's September. So September being seven, you know, SEPTA is seven, whenever you look at the etymology of the word. And so 7/11 is a big thing, as well as 9/11, as far as I can see within the Mason and the esoteric version of the world. I mean,
gelatin on the 91st floor. What's that about? I must have missed Holly's show. Now I sound ignorant. Holly, help me out quickly. Anyway, somebody post up the notes for it. I'll read them out here. If somebody posts that, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes on with the number. Of course, the Freemason idea of the Joachim and Boaz thing, right? And so it's this two towers. The Masonic idea is there's two sides of you and you're supposed to converge into one. And so they always do the triptych thing. So if you
that's the gelatin art collective that was on the 91st floor.
Right. Oh, you're talking about the art students?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, even then, right? So the 91st floor, I mean, the numbers that the folks that set these events up, they love the numbers. So the 91st floor, really? So it comes down on 9/11. The art students are on the 91st floor. All these things are just circumstantial nonsense, but they love the numbers. One of the things that I hear often within the world these days is their symbols expose them. So the symbols and the way they like to behave with their numbers and their trickery with stuff exposes what they're doing. It's like they set it up to let everybody know who's in on it, what they're doing. But see, now that everybody knows about these numbers, when I say everybody, meaning people who pay attention,
right?
The people that pay attention that know about these numbers now can just pick it out like, it doesn't even have to be much of anything. You can just see the numbers and then know that there's something suspicious is happening. Whenever you see numbers like 33 people dead, you know, even in the most recent event, it was 33 people dead or something like that. And the first thing I do is I look at that number. I go, well, I'm not sure if I believe the story.
That's a Masonic number for those who don't know.
Right, right. 32 and 33 degree Masons and all that kind of stuff. And of course, the funny part for me with the Masons is it's a little off topic in a way, but they have such the whoever's trying to get into the Masonic order, the front loaded information looks pretty good. It looks pretty noble on its face. If it doesn't seem like Masonry is a bad thing whenever you look at it on its face, but it's this historical depth of knowledge and the contextual nature of history, which makes you wonder if they use the good for bad. So, and I don't know, it's all connected one way or another, without a doubt. And I just, but now here's some of the cool parts that this study, finite element study, was conducted by a university professor and was provided conclusive evidence that the building 7 did not collapse as it could have. Furthermore, we've recently gotten access to a wealth of knowledge on the building 1 and 2. So building 1 and 2, we now have enough information to model those buildings and do the same kind of modeling and show how those buildings, even if you were to collapse the floors that were hit, even if you just take out those columns, you would not see the collapse as it occurred on that day. So just by using simple math, and when I say simple math, these programs are just ones and zeros, of course. So in that sense, it's just simple math. It's a complicated program, but the simple math of modeling what would happen if you eliminated some of these things. And once you do that, you will see that those buildings would have done almost nothing, because those buildings, in contradiction to the narrative that the buildings were made poorly, they were a feat of engineering for their day. And they still are quite impressive, even though they no longer exist. I mean, here's something that that people don't think about. So people think that it's just the floor sitting on top, and that weight could have done something. But what you don't know is that building also was designed for hurricane winds. So who cares about whether a plane can hit the building?
Isn't it true? It wasn't the first time an airplane hit the building, too. Hadn't an airplane hit it many years before?
Well, that was the Empire State Building,
okay,
which is
that's right.
Not too dissimilar of, it's a high-rise building that right. was hit by a plane, and nothing significant happened to the building in terms of structural failures. There's localized failures, but nothing significant like a global collapse. But so these buildings are massive, 110 story tall wind sails. I mean, the amount of wind pressure that can be generated by these buildings has been reported in the, was it 13,000 tons or something like that of wind pressure that they're designed to resist.
Yeah, and somebody just posted an analogy like a beer can, throwing a beer can into a house.
Yeah. Exactly.
And expecting it to knock the house down, you know?
Right. If you fill up the beer can and leave it fully loaded and throw it through a window and you expect the entire house to fall down, is a good analogy of thinking that you can knock that building down with one plane or two planes or whatever. It just could not happen. And the only reason why people have accepted it, as far as I can tell, is the shock and awe of it. If you're not politically inclined when that event happened, just like myself, you just blow it off as just something that happened. It wasn't until somebody identified it through, you know, the various movies, you know, Loose Change and stuff like that. I didn't even see Loose Change wasn't the thing. Joseph, what's the guy's name? who made Zeitgeist. Zeitgeist was the one.
Peter Joseph. Well, yeah. Well, and that's a, you know, that was a very misleading propaganda film too, you know.
However, it brought up interesting points about the sun worship, that whole thing. And then
he made a lot of misnomers that I've since discovered too, you know. I mean, and I was caught into that early research, and then later on we found out that the Theosophists seeded all of that to make Christianity look like it was an evolutionary religion out of that stuff. But when you delete the Dark Ages and you realize this huge empire called Tartary existed and that was all contemporary, then all of those arguments start to dwindle and fall apart pretty fast, you know. But, you know, it's like, yeah, so, you know, so Peter J. puts out this Zeitgeist film, and so that's kind of what tips you off and to finally start looking, you know. And I was so pulled into the stuff, I actually sat next to him in Ataria S during the LA premiere of that film. You know, and he had used several images in his video that he had, let's just say, taken and used without my permission.
Mm. Oh, right, because your previous research on...
Right.
Yeah, the mushroom connection.
Which I have since exposed, you know, because I was, you know, working with all of these professors at the time that were all, you know, and people have seen me, most of the audience has seen my exposure of that research over the last 7 years now, and going into the MKUltra aspects, and all of these professors I worked with were all citing each other in a big circle jerk, and none of them were citing the primary citations and getting down to the facts. I started checking all of the primaries, and not one of their claims was standing up, so I had to abandon all that research.
The primary source issue has been pretty interesting to me, and I can't say that I've done much primary source research at all, other than the fact that I know how engineering works, so I know clearly how buildings do not operate, which is they do not fall the way they did on that day. I mean, even beyond, there's a number of buildings that have had huge, massive, full building fires since that day, and they did not collapse. I mean, there's one in South America. I believe it was in, it may have been in Brazil. There was one in Iran, but the one in Iran looks to be another form of a false collapse, meaning that it was a problem building with all kinds of problem people in it, and it was basically a whole squatters hotel. The entire building was just filled with squatters, and so this building had some kind of fire. It ended up collapsing, but it wasn't a rational collapse. So the governments of the, I mean, my problem at this moment is governments, because I just, governments are a problem on this planet. In terms of the people that are running governments are doing bad things left and right and center. They just do bad things. So when you're constantly doing bad things, you set yourself up for the risk of being blackmailed into doing more bad things. and I mean, that's how 9/11 worked out, is through the blackmail chain, blackmailing everybody to keep most everybody quiet, except for the few that spoke out, and they either died or were diminished through media manipulation.
So what's the most damning engineering evidence that you've found?
Well, the conservation momentum is the issue for me. Because it's the easiest one to comprehend for most people. The most damning evidence is, one of the most damning evidence for Building 7, first off, is the analysis by Hulsey. Second is this lawsuit and report by the Weidlinger Associates in 2016 about Building 7.
That lawsuit say?
Cases made publicly available, it argues that the falling 13th floor in the Nordenson section of the Arup analysis could not shear the 12th floor girder seat at column 79. So it says that the girder, the main argument is that one girder connection failed and it brought down the entire building. And in 2016, this court case proved that the failure of the one girder could not even fail the next girder connection down. So they showed that if you even if the girder could have fallen, as was described by the NIST report, it could not have collapsed just the one floor below it. It could not have even broken the girder connection of the one floor below it. It didn't have enough energy.
Interesting.
So that is a second extremely damning. So these are big facts as it relates to that building. I find that most people can't really hear facts. So I don't mess around with the facts too much, because to me the facts are heavily involved. To me, this event is an emotional event. People can't get over the emotion.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, more than half the population now believes or knows that it was an inside job. So let's pretend for a moment that we're speaking to my audience who likes facts.
Okay.
And you know, far fewer of them are emotional thinkers. So, you know, what are all the core facts that we want to lay out?
So Building 7, the model is that this column at column 79 at the 13th floor, a girder connection failed. Within that failure mode, they made the bearing plates too small. They didn't include any side stiffener plates. They did not include the steel shear studs that connect the steel to the concrete. They didn't do any interaction between the steel beams and the girder and the connection of the concrete, which all work together as a system. And then furthermore, they made other assumptions on the outside where they made the outside perfectly rigid. So it's suggested that the outside walls wouldn't move at all during some kind of internal event. So there's a lot of assumptions that were made to allow for the spot failure in their analysis. And even in the spot failure of their analysis, you'll find that the model that they put out there shows a collapse scenario of a building that partially collapsed, doesn't fully collapse.
Much less atomize as it's falling and turn into fine dust.
Well, classic controlled demolition cuts columns at 60 feet lengths so that they can be easily transported offsite. And so what you do is you cut each whatever. So maybe in 60 feet, there's four floors, 15 foot, 16 foot floor to floor heights. You cut every fourth floor so that whenever it gets down to the bottom, you can just pick off 60 foot chunks of beams and columns and move them offsite, because that's what you do when you control demolition.
That's what it was at 9/11, was 60 foot columns.
Yeah. The efficiency from which they were able to remove building debris was criminal and also very efficient. And they were able to pick up pieces and move it onto boats and move it over to China. I don't know this for a fact, but according to everybody's reporting, that all of it was picked up, put on boats, and shipped over to China for dismantling and elimination of the evidence, honestly.
Yeah.
That was Building 7. Building 1 and 2, for me, the same thing is going to happen. Now that we have a more fuller picture of the complete structural system, you could have made an assumption on how those buildings were made without the actual information. But now we're actually getting information through FOIA requests, and we're going to be able to model Building 1 and Building 2. Now, it's going to take time. It took 2 years to get the Building 7 analysis done, so it's going to take time. But, I'm hopeful that within 5 years, it sounds like a long time, but I'm hopeful that within 5 years that we'll have a working model of how Building one or two, because they're built the exact same way. Building one of those towers, how it could have fallen. And it will show that it can't fall that way. And then furthermore, the interesting part was that we'll actually be able to start cutting columns and show that the building, and show the progressive collapse of the building as it was done in real life. So you can make a model that basically demonstrates what happened in real life. Of course, in real life, huge bombs were exploded. I mean, you don't see, when you demo a building, you don't use Hollywood size explosions, because you're not looking to dustify the entire city of New York. You're looking to bring the building down with minimal debris and be able to move it off site. So buildings one and two were not a classic demolition. They used huge explosives to take out that building. There's so much evidence that backs up it's interesting, because there's so much that will show you that there's access to the building's core prior to the events. And so with access gives you the opportunity to do something. Now, I'm not sure if anybody has any information on the people who were in there doing the work, or they don't have, I don't think there's any evidence that says that they put explosives into the buildings, but the wreckage, one of the more damning things is the evidence of nanothermite. So nanothermite is a popular accelerant used to cut steel in a quick fashion. So it has this ability to get to a highly explosive level, but it's not really explosive. It just heats up to a point where it basically can cut steel right in half. But even that is still incredible. I mean, there's photographs of 45 degree cuts in the box columns. I know there's at least one photograph of an exact 45 degree cut of a box column for the World Trade Center.
Yeah, towers. I remember seeing that.
But then the dust had all the nanothermite in it, and that was figured out through chemical analysis. And then furthermore, the foundry, as described by fire departments, people in the fire department of New York City, they found that there's just a flow of molten steel at the base of the towers. And according to the timeline, the underground fires took 3 months to extinguish. So it took 3 months for the fires to basically finish burning, according to the timeline, which is an incredibly good fire.
Yeah.
If only we had fires that lasted 3 months in our house, right? Then we wouldn't need much to keep warm at night.
Well, and that's why I found interest in Dmitry Kolosov's work, because his theory explained that. I'd have to go back over and review his, and then you have the whole issue of Larry Silverstein saying pull it, and then what do you get, like several billion dollars for each building or whatever, that, you know, when it fell down, he was awarded so much money, it was ridiculous. And he had just barely put out the insurance policies on them like a few months before.
Correct. And so when you look at that timeline, you find that there was a $1.2 billion policy on the buildings prior to him buying the buildings. And so he bought the buildings in 2001, and then he put a policy of $3.5 billion on the buildings. And then he, on the day of, right after they were hit, he started talking to his insurance company about identifying it as terrorist attacks, so that he can have two insurance claims. He ended up making $4.5 billion as part of the lawsuit that resulted from that. And then he went on to sue the two airlines, for additional $3 something million, but that lawsuit hasn't moved forward all the way. That lawsuit is, I think it's still an appeal court, maybe, but it may have died. But he even got additional monies back from the Port Authority from New York, from the state of New York. They gave him money back on his whenever he bought it from them. They gave him some money back. So, I mean, from a financial standpoint, I mean, he made out quite well.
So Owen in the chat says that Larry was recently seen on YouTube talking about how they, quote unquote, started planning the new building in 2000.
Oh, right.
And thanks, Polygonal, for donating $2.99 donations. Thanks, Sammy. And thanks, Meredith, for your donations as well. Much appreciated. So, you know, I mean, this is such a weird event, but, you know, essentially it was used as a political tool to herd the population. Now everybody goes through these TSA checkpoints whenever you fly and stuff like that, and then they've never really caught anybody doing anything or, you know, any of this stuff, but yet we've all surrendered our rights because of this, and it's like 20 years on, and people are still culled into this, you know, remember 9/11 mentality.
I mean, this is the first year that I've started to look at it as a holiday. So I try to minimize the amount of business that I do on this day, because, I mean, for me, it's as much of a holiday as anything, because it was basically the birth of me starting to pay attention in this world. Because prior to that event, all I was doing was what I was told.
So on September 11th, 2001, let's see, I had just been through the divorce, having found my wife of 7 years at the time in an affair with her boss, the atypical boss affair. And my divorce had just finished a few months before then. And so I had another apartment, and my roommate wakes me up at like 6:30 in the morning, you know, freaked out. Hey, we're under attack and all this stuff. And I remember going out there and I watched 20 or 30 minutes of the news reports. And then I got up and I said, it's a false flag. And I headed back to bed, and my roommate and his friend were there. And I remember them just yelling at me, how could I say such a thing, and yada, yada, yada. And, you know, but I could just see all of the typical media manipulation tactics. So that morning, I remember identifying it as a false flag operation.
Good for you. I mean,
All right, well, let's get back into some more of the meat and potatoes. So what else you have for us, Casey?
Well, I guess there's we're going to try to, in working with the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, we're going to try to start to talk to professional organizations like the American Society of Civil Engineers to try to put some pressure on them. They're hard to track down, though. Most official organizations won't touch the topic.
Yeah, not even to refute it. Not even to say, here's how you're wrong, how you're wrong, how you're wrong.
Right. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring it to the table a little bit more, like it's a duty upon the whole industry to make sure that they are certain about what happened on that event and how buildings collapsed. So a way to think of it is, recently there have been some incidences up in Oakland where fires have happened, and then there's handrail failures and
handrail failures. And so, did the handrail failure cause the building to collapse?
No, but it caused the entire building industry to really clamp down on handrail design. So immediately, within less than a month, the entire industry went bonkers over handrails. And then if you go back to 1993, 94, 95, you had earthquakes that hit Los Angeles, San Francisco, then Los Angeles, then Kyoto, Japan. And those three earthquakes shut down the building department, the building process code for 10 years until they could figure out what happened so that it doesn't happen again. So they changed all the codes dramatically at that time. And so whenever dramatic failures happen in the engineering world, dramatic changes happen to the building code. Nothing changed after 9/11.
So,
no changes.
So how many buildings in history have fallen down from getting hit by an airplane or having a fire? Wasn't there a huge fire at the top of some huge skyscraper recently in Asia that didn't fall down?
Oh, yeah. The entire skyscraper was burning head to toe. No collapse.
And so let's see. There was a Dubai skyscraper fire. It didn't fall down. You know, so look at it. These are all like huge skyscraper fires and whatnot, and none of these buildings falling down. I mean, you know, this one looks like it's pouring some molten or something down the side. But so, you know, where are the buildings that just turn to dust and vaporize?
Well, yeah, that's the other interesting part of those two buildings for me is, and that's where I think you brought up Judy Wood. One of the things that's really curious for me with the Judy Wood thing is that certain things don't add up. It's like, so whenever you look at 9/11, interesting part of side story into the, is that not only was there dustification, but there were some weird other things that happened to cars. And then whenever you look at the recent events of the fires, the forest fires that happened in California, and where there's a lot of people saying that directed energy weapons were used, you know, laser beams from planes, just like that movie Real Genius. Wasn't it Real Genius? That was where the yeah, it was Real Genius where they were trying to work out a guidance system and a laser for the army, and they ended up using it to make popcorn in somebody's house, right? So it's this funny little movie about directed energy weapons. But then there's these fires in California that appear to be not really forest fires. And there's other people taking photographs of what could be forms of directed energy weapons. And you see the same thing of that's happening at cars in those locations as what you saw to the cars on 9/11. So for me, whether Judy Wood is correct or not, I don't know. But there is similarities historically now between the weird events that happened in the California fires and what happened to cars and what happened on 9/11. So,
interesting.
I don't know that we're ever going to come to the full and complete truth. My only hope is that we come to the clarity that the building, all three of those buildings could not have collapsed based on office fires because the building code didn't change. Nothing in the building code changed.
So, I'm going to show an image. Now, I used to live in Belgrade, Serbia for a while on and off during the wars with my first wife. And so now the United States, when I just before, like a week before I had gotten there, bombed a crap load of the downtown Belgrade buildings. Now I'm going to show these are my photos that I took. These are from 1999. Now the United States hit the Belgrade TV and news station tower with a direct hit of a guided missile right into the top of it, and the building, do you think it came down?
No.
All right, there it is. That's after the United States hit it with a missile. And I had a friend who lived directly across the street from that, and he lost all the windows in his apartment, scared the crap out of his daughter and whatnot. Now, you know, so there's a lot of buildings that the U.S. hit. And here's another one. Oh, geez, goodness, wrong window. Here's another one. They bombed this building. That was the downtown police station. Did not fall down. Here was the Hotel Yugoslavia. They bombed it and did not fall down. All of these buildings that the U.S. bought, you know, the only thing that they were able to knock down entirely was a famous tower. And let me see if I can find it. Mount Avila Tower. Now, I got in trouble taking this photo. The guard was not happy. But this was the famous Mount Avila Tower that was like the Serbian Eiffel Tower, so to speak. And they did knock it down. So there is that tower, and there's me standing next to it. And then a couple of minutes later, the security guard comes out, not happy with me at all for photographing that. And he comes and runs me out, and that's him there. But, you know, so the reason why the U.S. knocked this down, it was all their communications and radio towers and stuff. And so they would be able to relay radio everywhere. But, you know, this is the only one. And they hit that with numerous missiles to take it down. This is the only one that they were able to knock totally down. And this is with, you know, the full power of the U.S. Military and NATO forces going after this micro-sized country that did so happen to be like the eighth most powerful military in the world at the time. But it took the full power of the U.S. government to even knock down this tower. And, you know, so it was interesting seeing things from a ground level and going around now. You know, another interesting thing is I was there when the here's the Chinese embassy. So the U.S. Pretends that they hit the the Chinese embassy on accident. And so this is my own photograph of the Chinese embassy. And again, the building did not fall down. Now, what had happened is they had collected a number of U.S. stealth bombers. That's why they don't use the stealth bombers anymore, is because they figured out how to reverse engineer their stealthness. And the Serbs pulled out their old World War II radar systems and were able to start knocking them out of the sky. But, you know, so the Chinese embassy, none of these buildings hit by direct missiles fell down. You know, so, you know, how many buildings do we have to see that the U.S. hits directly? And here's another side view of that TV station, or not TV station, but all the TV networks basically had their offices in that building. But, you know, so the missile comes down right through the top of the building. You can see the missile hit right there on the top edge of the building. Doesn't take the building down, even a direct hit by a guided missile. So, you know, these buildings are pretty tough, and that Serbian TV station building was like, what, 30, 40 stories or something like that. It wasn't huge, but, you know, not so easy to take down. Got any? Go ahead.
Well, if they're easy to take down, then engineers wouldn't be very good at their job. That's what kills me about the whole thing with structural engineers is, one, they're too busy, you know, it doesn't matter, so on and so forth. However, engineers seem to care about these other failures that have occurred throughout history. Why don't they care about this failure? It's because of the propaganda that keeps people closed in to the media world, right? But I mean, there's no reason why structural engineers across the entire globe shouldn't worry about the collapse of three buildings due to fires. I mean, if fires could collapse buildings, then why would they have fireproofing? There's so much nonsense that people accept about these buildings collapsing. Because it's just easier, I guess. I mean, your audience is more educated. Your audience cares more. And that's why it's a great opportunity to have this discussion on this day, since it is Tuesday, exactly 17 years.
And Holly says the California fires look like ionosphere weapons.
Right, exactly. Some kind of ionosphere or some kind of heated up beam of some sorts, which there's some kind of technology going on that is not tree fires, because tree fires burn trees. I mean, the great part about those California fires is that there's trees standing next to burnt buildings. And
yeah, they're burning the buildings and not the trees. And trees are obviously easier to burn than buildings.
And cars. Cars are burnt and not the trees. There's so many weird things that happened across those various fires. I mean, the most recent one is pretty ugly. People actually have images of some kind of light beam in a number of incidences. And then a number of firefighters have come forward and said these fires are not natural. There's some pretty interesting claims as it relates to it in terms of the ability to accelerate fires.
Polygonal Construction says fires are plasma. Plasma can be manipulated. What do you think of that?
Well, I'm not a plasma expert. I don't know how to answer that question. Yeah, fire. I mean, the issue for me is that unnatural things happened during those fires, and some of the unnatural things, as it relates to structures and cars, seem to also show up in that the 9/11. So that's the reason why I brought up the fires was because of that, the connection with Judy Wood and directed energy weapons. So Judy Wood's main, I haven't read all of her stuff. I just generally, I've watched one of or two of her presentations, and her main thing is that 9/11 was an expose of directed energy weapons. Of course, the amount of theories out there between I think there's a Russian, thing that says mini nukes were used to blow up the buildings.
Yeah, well, that was Dmitry Kolozov, I think.
Right. So, I mean, that would add up to me because...
Well, what he argued was that, if I recall correctly, and I did email with him years ago, I was going to have him on the show, but if I recall correctly, his argument was that when they built the buildings, because they were so large, they had to engineer a way ahead of time to bring the buildings down. And so what they did, per Kolozov, was they put nukes under the buildings so that when these were set off, it would create a cavern underneath each of the buildings that the buildings would then fall into, and then it would be a lot easier, simpler cleanup, etc.
Oh, yeah. Well, that I'm quite certain that happened. There is definitely eyewitness reports of explosions happening prior to the buildings collapsing below at the lower levels. So without a doubt, some form of explosion happened at the lower levels. And without a doubt, they had to do that in order to get most of that debris to fall into some place. But there was controlled demolition explosions all the way down the line. I mean, you didn't watch. So Building 7, you watched the building actually track down. It moved down. Buildings 1 and 2, they disintegrated as it went down. So they disintegrated from the top down, as where Building 7 was a classic demolition where you start taking out the bottom floors and you take it out as you go up so that it collapses uniformly.
Yeah, I was just I was just trying to find some of these, you know, see if I could find one of them, and I've got them somewhere in my archives. You know, I really haven't studied anything on 9/11 for probably 8 or 9 years now, to be honest, except for what you've told me and what you've looked into. But so here's one of them, just showing some of the controlled demolition stuff here, and let's see if they are showing it. But yeah, you can see the explosions going out, you know. What you have is explosions happening and blowing debris out from the side, out away from the building as each floor is coming down, and you can see these fire points going off. So why would there be a fire and explosions happening where a building is just collapsing, but you can see it, you know, you can see the fires just exploding outward around each of these collapse points, and it's going, you know, all down the sides of the building, et cetera, when it's happening.
So some of the things, so people look at that building and they'll, I'm not sure if I believe in the idea that the buildings were built to be able to be collapsed. The size of the columns of the interior core is incomprehensible for most people. They were box columns made out of 4-inch thick steel plates. If you've never experienced what steel can do, then you don't really know what a 4-inch thick steel plate is. It is incredible. And whenever you box that in with four sides and turn it into a column, and you've got more, 20? I never really have the stats in my head. But there is a lot of columns around the core, the elevator core of the building. And then even exterior columns. People think that those exterior columns were insignificant. Those exterior columns were boxed steel columns on the outside of the building at 3 feet on center, 3 foot, 3 feet on center. I mean, the vertical system of this building was impressive, much less the lateral system to be able to resist the wind load. So these buildings were massively significant. And to try to suggest that you could make them disappear or you could crush them with any kind of weight that was above them is crazy. Here's the thing. Deflection is a very special thing in structural systems. Deflection is something that you're trying to control to make sure that people don't feel bad. So buildings are designed so that, because beams can deflect more than their strength will allow them to deflect more than what is comfortable for humans. So you can have a beam and it can just be sloping, just like bridges. Bridges are highly deflected elements. You see the suspension bridges, highly deflected elements that are existing based on strength and not based on some kind of deflection. And these twin towers had to be designed to prevent sway back and forth. So they were over-designed just to deal with the sway problem of being 110 stories tall and not making everybody throw up at the top of their building. So imagine if you've ever ridden a train, you know what it feels like to do this all day long. Well, imagine doing that in an office building every day where you're just doing like this. And by the time you get down to your car, you can't even drive straight because your head's doing this every right. single
it's
day.
It's like when you get off a boat or something, you know?
Right. Right. So these buildings are designed to prevent that. So they're overly strong just to deal with the wind force, not only the wind force, but the deflection that results from that wind force to make sure that people don't throw up. And another interesting thing about vibration is if you've ever driven across a bridge, for some reason, it feels like you're going over speed bumps.
Right.
You're going, dun, 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 dun. Right. The reason is because bridges vibrate. Everything vibrates. Most people should generally know by now that everything vibrates, even if they don't. They should know that everything vibrates. Well, whenever you get long spans like bridges, they constantly are in a standing wave. Even if there's no load on them, they're constantly in a standing wave. It just accelerates depending on how much wind is on them and how many cars are driving across. Same thing happens with a big tower building. It's always in a standing wave. So you have to make the building stiff enough to keep that standing wave to an acceptable level so that people just don't lose their lunch.
So somebody asked, and we can probably take some questions from the audience. Rugi asked, was this a religious event, an anti-religious event, clash of civilizations, controlled opposition, all of the above? What was it in your opinion?
Well, it was without a doubt a political event.
It is exactly a week before Yom Kippur.
I think there was some kind of ritual, religion, combination that's involved with it. But I can't say that I can know one way or the other. The connections of the dates, the precognition that was embedded in movies, the beginning of the building was curious. Those two buildings have a very auspicious beginning. I don't know all the facts, but they're connected into Saudi Arabia and they're connected into 9/11. And so it's primarily on its face, it was a political event to foment lots of war, without a doubt.
Fear, get people sure. to give up their rights, etc. I think that's yeah. probably the biggest thing, is just strip everyone's rights away and say, hey, you know, we need to take your rights away to keep you safe. I mean, that's how tyrants always do things.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the primary motive, but the secondary motives were pretty deep. I'm sure there was some kind of esoteric, symbolic part of it. There's obviously a financial component to it, the ability to continue to do war and profit off of that, as well as profit directly off of the event itself. The James Corbett guy, he put out an interesting video just talking about the war games, the unprecedented. It was the first time that that we were introduced to this. I was introduced to this false flag narrative where they create a drill on the day that they're going to bring a real life event forward. So they do a drill. They set up a drill. So they got people in place to put up what's the idea where it gives you an excuse to say you didn't know.
Right.
I forget what it's called.
Plausible deniability.
So it sets up that operative thing. So you can create confusion and have good people not do their jobs because they're confused by the scenario in front of them.
Now, I used to do shows with this guy years ago who had this whole theory, and I was just trying to pull it up in the database, but his theory was that there was all the world's gold was stored in the basements of the Twin Towers, and that, you know, after the towers hit, they had trucks down there, and they were loading up all the gold, and then someone did the math on it, and if you had a bunch of forklifts going, they would have to slam into the back of the big rigs to knock the gold off to get it onto the trucks fast enough and all of that, and the weight and everything. It was ended up being total nonsense. But do you have anything to say on the gold aspect? Do you think there's anything to that?
I've seen those theories. I haven't looked into them at all. There was a monetary thing that was going on. There is some other political things connected into 2001 as well. Something about some kind of bankruptcy or some kind of charter of banks. There's a lot of other political things that were directly tied into 2001 in September that were not just... there's so many interesting aspects of that day. It's staggering. I don't know that I can say anything about the gold, but I wouldn't doubt it necessarily.
Well, yeah, you know, when you see, you know, his theory, and there was a really good thread on this website Conversant, and I can't pull it up now. The website is still there, but the what I had found, you know, this guy had done a mathematical debunking, just showing the weight of the gold, the amount of gold, the number of trucks it would have required, the number of forklifts, the timing of the forklifts going back and forth, how much each forklift could carry. You know, the only way that the forklifts could have possibly got the gold on the trucks would have been to drive at full speed, hit the back of the truck to knock the gold onto the truck, then, you know, back up, you know, as quickly as possible for the next one to do the exact same thing, and then get these big rigs closed up with all this gold and, you know, out from underneath the Twin Towers and all of this stuff. And, yeah. You know, the way this guy broke it down, it just, you know, it really destroyed the theory, but we had also discovered that the his whole whistleblower thing, we actually found his court records, and the court records showed that the whole whistleblower thing was a fraud as well. So anyway,
I mean, another thing that comes up to my head was the because there's a hurricane now approaching the East Coast.
Virginia, and my parents are in Virginia right now.
Yeah, so everybody's getting pretty excited about that. Well, there was a hurricane on 9/11 in 2001.
Was it really?
And somehow it turned 90 degrees away from New York City. It was set to hit New York City on 9/11. And it turned 90 degrees and petered away.
So tell us about architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Well, they're a pretty impressive organization. Richard Gage was the originator of it. And he's an architect out of San Francisco. And they have not given up. They have continued to build more and more information demonstrating that the official story is not possible, and are gathering more and more momentum. One of the most impressive things is getting enough money to pay a professor at a university to be able to analyze Building 7. Because that was the building.
And then as far as I can tell, all of the tenured professors in the universities, or at least most of them, look like they're on the take. You know, I've exposed so many university professors and so many universities. It's ridiculous at this point. It's like, all right, which one of you tenured professors is not dirty? And that's part of the thing, because, you know, when you realize that the peer review system is how they control information, they have to control the professors.
Yeah, and I think it's a difficult place to start from. So Leroy Halsey, I'm not sure where he was before he started this investigation. I think he was fairly innocent-minded whenever he started. He didn't have the conspiratorial view of the world, potentially, that I now have. right. And it's interesting because his investigation and analysis has opened up a scary little hole in his mind about the potential. So even discussing the rollout of the report and the models, the idea is to not actually trust the various universities and official organizations within the United States. Because there's a good chance that they're somehow co-opted and will try to bury it as much as possible. So there's talk about trying to bring that to different countries first or at the same time.
Yeah. You know, and thanks everyone in the chat for donating. Thank you, Bahara, all of you for supporting the show tonight. Next week, I'm going to have to skip the show. I have eye surgery next Tuesday. I appreciate any and all donations toward that. I managed to raise about 10% of the funds begging for donations over the last week. We raised about $400, maybe $500. So anybody who wants to contribute towards that, I'm going to post the donation link in the chat. How can people reach you, Casey?
Well, I within the show notes, I think I gave you a lot of the information. I wanted to make sure that people did recognize the various individuals that have been really pushing forward the truth on this, including Richard Gage, Roland Engel, Tom Zambodi, Andrew Steele, Dan Barnum, Leroy Halsey, Ron Brookman, and Kamal Obaid. I wanted to make sure that they get recognized as well as all the various other, there's so many other ones that I didn't have time to list. That www.ae911truth.org is the main website for all of this information. And there are two other websites that are connected to the evaluation of WTC7, and also the 9/11 Free Fall, which is a podcast where you can find another podcast from me on this topic. My email address that I use for this for this communication is marshall@agentsatlaw.com. That's MARSHALL at agentsatlaw.com. That's AGENTSATLAW.com.
And you have anything else you'd like to add for tonight? Anything we missed?
No, I just hope that people, it'd be nice if when people talk to other people about it, they can kind of bring a little bit of these thoughts to them, because as most people well know, facts are very difficult for people to digest. The amount of facts that are out there are you can't even count up the amount of facts involved in this day. And it was fun to talk about it with you, and it was good to see you again.
Yeah, you too. You know, one of these days, maybe I should create a brain database just for 9/11 and start mapping the stuff and see what pulls up that way. I haven't even ever tried to do that, you know. But
there's a number of guys that would definitely get into it. I'd check in with those guys and see, because those guys, if they knew how to run the brain data, they would be the ones to build it, because a number of these guys just have all the connections down pat.
It took me, Holly and I, three or four weeks plugging data into the brain database to solve, you know, a 326-year-old scam called the Salem Witch Trials, and who really did that and what was behind that. And discovering that was, very enlightening, and still working on the book on that to get that done. We're about halfway done with it, and she and I really need to get busy on that. But, it was basically what we discovered was that those who were accused of doing it didn't do it, and another group did it, and they were using poisons, using cinnabar ore, or mercury ore, which is cinnabar, and other stuff to poison people. And then all of this was used as an agenda to sell feminism and anti-Christian rhetoric and all of this stuff, when the Christians had nothing to do with the event. The Puritans we discovered were conversos or crypto Jews, essentially, and they had used that as a cover, essentially. But when they had been kicked out of Europe for the plagues and for getting caught doing human sacrifice and things like that, they put on a cloak of Christianity, and then they founded the Bay Colony. A lot of them left. Most of them were from Holland and England, and they started the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And then you had Cromwell and these guys who were behind all of this on the back scene, and we found out a lot of connections with him. But none of the official story checked out. What we found was a blueprint that the CIA and these operatives, whether they're MI6 or Mossad or whomever that tells this stuff, they have a blueprint that they use. And in nearly every single book that we checked on Salem followed this same blueprint. And so I'm sure that's probably what most will find when they investigate 9/11, you have to use the trivium, you have to use fact-checking, get down to the primaries, check your thinking, make sure you're not using fallacies, you know, remove any of that, and get down to the core of the stuff so that you can figure it out for sure.
I think that effort has somewhat occurred. I have no idea how deep it has occurred. Like yourself, I don't spend too much time on the story because it's so obvious to me. And I've got other things that I'm doing. But yeah. It's so obvious to me that the official story is not possible.
Right. All right. Well, thank you so much, Casey. Thanks, everybody in the audience. Thanks for all your support. And we will see you probably this coming Sunday for the Logos Roundtable, but I will not be seeing you next Tuesday. And hopefully I get through the eye surgery all right and don't come out blind. So if I come out blind, I probably won't see you for a long time after that. Good night, everybody. And good night. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.